On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk Kill Bill, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I am your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm your host, Matthew Essery.
And on this week's episode, we are talking Quentin Tarantino. And I know one of your favorite directors.
He is. He might be my. You know, the more I think about it, he might be my favorite director. The more time goes on, I mean, I love his work because, in a lot of ways, he is a guy like you and me.
Right.
He loves movies, and he has the opportunity to express his love of movies. Where, you know, he's not doing a podcast. He's literally taking his love of movies and things he likes, things he would recommend, and putting them into a blender, mixing them up, and basically making these almost film remixes of all the films that he likes.
Yeah,
and I really respond to that as a film geek. I respond to that whole vibe. I really dig it.
All right, well, we will get into it, sir, as we talk about Kill Bill Volume 1 and Volume 2. Since this is episode 30, always on the 10s, we try to do sequel movies. And even though that this is Volume 1 and Volume 2, they were released 1 year, like one right after another. Mm-hmm. The DVD for Volume 1 was released like 1 week before Volume 2 came out. So October of 2003 is when Kill Bill Volume 1 was released. And then Kill Bill Volume 2 was released in October of 2004. Mm-hmm. But they were intended as one movie, I hear.
Yes. Originally, Tarantino intended for the film to be one, I believe, 3.5-hour film. The script is really, there's no division in the script. It's one story, and it really cross-cuts both films into one thing.
Right.
But when he went to Miramax with this finished film, the Weinsteins, who we're not going to talk a whole lot about anymore because screw the Weinsteins.
But they were still in control of, like, Miramax and, like, what they were going to, put out. He was still the producers
at the time. At the time, they were kind of the king of, like, non-family Hollywood, you know?
Yeah.
And they were like, we don't want to put out a 3-hour, like, kung fu spaghetti western thing.
Yeah.
So can you cut it down? And Tarantino, being Tarantino, was like, no, I'm not going to cut it down. So they really argued about this for like 6 months. And they finally came to the compromise of, well, let's split it up and release it in segments.
Right. Yeah, so that was like the compromise. Like, because I think that it was Quentin Tarantino was kind of faced with, should I cut stuff that I feel has artistic integrity, or do I just release them as two, kind of like a double album? Kind
yes.
of, you know what I mean? Like, you know, does the White Album come out as, do we not release the White Album and just like cut out some of those songs and just trim the fat?
Yeah.
Or do we release just like a double album
yeah.
and charge more for it or whatever?
Yeah, and it's really got the feeling of like an A and B side kind of thing. And yeah. he didn't just cut the script in half. He actually re-edited the films to give them each their own unique, like, beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah.
Where it still tells one story, but you can kind of watch them individually and still get, a full experience.
Right. So some of the audience or some of our listeners may have, experienced Quentin Tarantino in other films like Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown,
Reservoir Dogs,
Inglourious Basterds,
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which, just came out on home video to to date this podcast. Yeah. Yeah.
That's probably his most linear film to date, I think, is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes.
There's not a lot of, like, out-of-sequence stuff.
No, there's not.
Yeah, but, I mean, Pulp Fiction was very sort of out-of-sequence, mm-hmm. but he did that for, like, dramatic effect. He yes. shot everything linear, but then he thought, you know, for more dramatic effect, he's going to end, you know, on a different, like, he's going to end with Jules, like, you know, yes. leaving. But that's a different kind of thing. Like, this, yeah. he actually re-edited, because to me, it's kind of like what you mentioned at the beginning, kind of like a mashup between a Western and a kung fu movie,
yeah.
and originally, I, you know, you can kind of see his idea of, like, it all sort of blending together.
Yes.
But then when he edited, he kind of, like, volume one is more like the kung fu and his, like, tribute to kung fu, mm-hmm. and then, like, volume two is more of his, like, tribute to spaghetti westerns.
Yes. And now there's a little bit of both in each of them, but definitely they're more so one than the other.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into it.
Yes.
Let's get into the IMDb. Volume one.
Synopses.
The lead character called the Bride was a member of the deadly Viper assassination squad led by her lover Bill. Upon realizing that she was pregnant with Bill's child, the Bride decided to escape her life as a killer. She fled to Texas, met a young man who on the day of their wedding rehearsal was gunned down by an angry and jealous Bill with the assistance of the deadly Viper assassination squad. Vicious. I added the part. 4 years later, the Bride wakes up from a coma and discovers her baby is gone. Then she decides to seek revenge upon five people who destroyed her life and killed her baby. The saga of Kill Bill Volume 1 begins. And that was written by JD. Thank you, JD.
Thank you, JD, from the Internet IMDb. Movie Database. Yeah. We salute you. So first of all, I got to say how much I love the name Deadly Viper Assassination Squad.
Yes.
Only in a Tarantino movie could you say something so ridiculous and it became treated completely straight.
Yes.
And what a ridiculous, like, exploitation-esque title. And they all have code names.
Yeah, I mean, it's like something that some, you know, middle school wrote. Like, that would be
yeah.
like your...
scribbling in his notebook, yeah.
Yeah, right. Like, and even some of the names of some of the other... like people in the movie, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just it's really, really great.
But so yeah, Kill Bill Volume 1 is very much an homage to kung fu movies, an homage to
go ahead
samurai films and kind of Asian action films in general.
Right. But Uma Thurman, like, she's known. She plays the main character.
Yes.
Her name is, well, I mean, they call her the Bride.
Yes, for some odd, they make an odd choice of not saying what her name is in the first film. It's beeped out every time they say it.
Right. That's what the beeping was.
Yes.
I kept hearing beeping, like, I'm, like, watching this movie, and I'm going, what's beeping? Is there something beeping?
Yeah, did you think, like, the DVD what? I got you what? Was messed up or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, I thought, I was like, what's wrong with my DVD?
No, it's a
I was like, is my sound messed up? And I just got this new TV, right? And I'm watching it on this nice big 55-inch, like, LCD TV.
I should have warned you.
And I'm like, I love this TV. It sounds so great.
Yeah.
Wait, what's this beeping?
I guess we should point out, this is going to mention that you've never seen these.
No, I have not.
Yeah.
I watched Pulp Fiction... like back, way back when.
Yeah.
Back when it was released and back when it was really released on video. I never saw it in the movie theater. Mm-hmm. I remember it was out like the same time as like Jurassic Park. And that was like the movie to go see was Jurassic Park. And it was weird to go to the movie theater and see, you know, movie place playing, you know, Jurassic Park. And then they're playing like Pulp Fiction. Now, granted, mm-hmm. they only played it like at the 7:30 and like the 9:30 show. Yeah. You know, they didn't. Play it at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, we don't want to get too divergent, but Pulp Fiction was the first kind of indie film to hit it really big in mainstream. But
so, anyway, but tell everybody, tell the listeners what Uma Thurman's actual name is.
Well, her actual name is Beatrix Kiddo.
Beatrix, that's a great video.
That's a great name. And what's funny is they refer to her as Kiddo in the first film. And you think it's just like a nickname, like sport, pal, or, you know, chief.
Like, hey, kiddo.
Yeah, but yeah. No, her name is actually Beatrix Kiddo, which, again, what a great name.
We should have all these names in our video culture, like, journal.
Well, one day we're going to start a forum, and there's going to be a mad dash for all those names, like Noodles McIntosh.
Yeah.
Never forget. callback.
What was the guy's name from Twins? What was his name? Like, oh, I can't remember. Never mind.
Oh, well, we're going to edit that part out.
That was another show. That was a different show. That wasn't this show. Yeah. All right.
We got to record these earlier in the day if you're going to ask me to dig back into my memory that much, you know?
Right. Either which way. So, yeah, Uma Thurman wakes up from this coma and...
Goes on a path of revenge, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she's a trained killer. She was a part of this assassination squad.
Yeah, basically, this movie operates under what I call kung fu movie logic.
Okay.
Like you know, everyone in the movie who matters is a badass. Mm-hmm. They're all, like, you know, tough, and they can fight. They're all good with weapons. They all say cool dialogue.
They have, like, the best reflexes you've ever seen in your entire life.
Yeah. And it's like just
unbelievable reflexes.
And you just accept it because that's the world of the film. They're basically superheroes.
Yeah.
And she wakes up and she basically makes a list of the people who wronged her, her former teammates.
Right.
The people who worked for this mysterious benefactor named Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting choices of this movie, besides bleeping out her name and keeping that mysterious in the first film, you never see Bill in the first film. You hear his voice. You see his hands.
Right.
But you never see his face.
Bill is played by David Carradine, who a lot of our audience will know as the guy in the Kung Fu TV show.
Yes.
From the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He and also in a lot of other movies. But yeah, I would think that's his most iconic role is Kane in Kung Fu. Yep. You know, walk the earth like Kane in Kung Fu.
Kane in Kung Fu, right. Yeah.
So obviously Tarantino was a fan.
Yes.
So she goes on this revenge tip. And it starts off where she gets into a knife fight with one of the characters whose name is Vernetta Green. He's kind of like almost like a black exploitation character in a way. And she shows up at this house, and he kind of just dropped into her like tale of revenge without really quite knowing what's going on in the beginning. With Tarantino's fractured structure, you kind of pick it up as you go along.
Well, let me just say that, you know, the first scene, it's like her fight between Vivica A. Fox and Uma Thurman. So Uma Thurman's coming after Vivica A. Fox, Vernetta Green. But you learn, like, she's kind of like the dialogue. There is a little bit of dialogue where she's kind of narrating a little bit. And you learn that it's like her second, like, I'm visiting my second victim or whatever. Yeah,
but you don't see her first yet.
Yeah, you don't see her first. So you're just like, okay, I'm kind of in the middle of, like, what's happening. So you don't know why. You don't know Uma Thurman's motions.
Well,
you don't know. Wait a second. You don't know the history.
She's being killed, right? Or they tried to kill her.
They tried to kill her. She doesn't know what this relationship with this other person is, other than maybe she tried to kill her, or they were associates of some kind. But it's like in a suburban, like, theater. Like, you know, looks like the street in Toy Story.
Yeah.
You know?
It looks like your typical, like, sitcom neighborhood. Right. Yeah. It's bright and sunny. You know,
there's,
it's like
trees,
middle of the afternoon.
There's a sidewalk. You know, there's big bay windows. You know, it's just, you know, it looks warm and cozy. And then here comes, you know, Uma Thurman in her pussy wagon, like, you know, truck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She pulls up this ridiculous, like, 70s looking truck that has the words pussy wagon spray painted on the side of it.
You don't know where it comes
from. Or airbrushed on
it. But what I'm saying is, like, and then in the middle of, so then she goes after Vivica Fox. They're fighting, they're, like, sword fighting and, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you see out the window, this big bay window, the school bus pull up, and you see a little girl get out, and you're just like, oh, snap. Like, things are running. Like, there's a big fight going on, and here comes the kid.
Yeah.
They both stop fighting. It gets the kid to, like, go upstairs. So there's, like, a pause. And, like, the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have a little discussion in the kitchen, which is also another, like, Quentin Tarantino thing.
Yes.
Like, a talk in the kitchen with coffee. You know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking,
doing some mundane task in while you talk about the plot.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then after that, like, she's like, I don't want you to kill me in front of my kid or, like, whatever. We don't want to do this. Yeah. You know.
And then she tries to double cross her and...
Right, and then, she tries to shoot at her, so she, like, throws a knife at her, hits her in the heart. Little girl comes walking downstairs, sees the whole thing, and it's like, I'm sitting there watching this. You have to remember.
You're a parent.
I'm a parent. I have an 8-year-old. I have, you know, a 3-year-old. It wasn't that long ago that I, you know, went through the whole thing of taking my daughter to school and, you know, where she's in kindergarten and she's walking off to class by herself.
Yeah.
And it was like, Whoa. So you, I mean, yeah, this is the intro scene.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, wait, I'm almost done.
Sure.
Said to myself, I'm like, I don't know if I want to watch this movie. Because Quentin Tarantino, such a visual artist, right? He's a tremendous visual artist. And all, like, the stuff like that, like, that was in the killings. Like, we watched a lot of movies where people have died.
Yeah.
But that was, like, the most realistic, like, sort of way. And I remember even in, like, Pulp Fiction and, like, other movies, I'm like, this is why I don't watch his movies all the time because the violence is, like, so, like, you know, real.
It's raw. Yeah. And what's interesting is that's probably one of the most realistic deaths in the entire film.
Yes.
Like, everything else is a little bit cartoony, a little bit over the top. That one is pretty dramatic.
Right.
And I think he tries to undercut it a little bit by Uma Thurman kind of talking to the daughter like she's Clint Eastwood. Like, you know, if you're still mad when you grew up, come find me and we can settle it. Like, that's right. A little bit absurd. So. Yeah. So I think he tries to deflate it a little bit like that. But you're right. The beginning is very kind of brutal and sudden.
Right.
And it has a little bit of that kung fu trope where, you know, they're honorable, where they're not going to fight in front of the kid.
Yeah.
And but it's still, it's harsh. And it's a harsh way to kind of jump into the movie. It gets a little sillier and a little lighter as it goes along. But that opening is kind of a gut punch. And I didn't even think about that when I recommended it. So my apologies.
No, it's not
But
your
I'm
fault.
Glad you stuck
no.
with it.
It's not your fault at all. Yeah. It's not your fault. It's one of the, you know, one of those things that, like, you know, like breakdown, it doesn't get to that real tense, you know, sort of thing until you get, like, sort of towards the end or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's always, and that one had attention throughout the movie, but this one was kind of like, you know, here I am in, like, the first, like, 10 minutes of this movie, and you get, like, a real huge gut punch, and you're like, what the heck am I watching? You know what I mean? So I also wanted to warn everybody that's listening, what, if you're going to watch these movies, if you haven't seen them, like, what you're sort of in for. Yeah. Now, I do agree with you, like, the rest of the killings, especially like the next one, which was actually like the first one, right?
Yeah.
Was more because there's less like on that character. Then it's like you kind of rewind and go back to how she broke out of the hospital.
Yeah, she wakes up from her coma.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the part that really makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because it references that she was sexually assaulted while she was in a coma. She ends up killing the guy who sexually assaulted her when she wakes up. And that's kind of an homage to like really grimy 70s revenge movies, and it's gross, and it makes you feel scuzzy, and I'm glad that part's what's challenging for me. So those two scenes are back to back too, which is interesting. And then the movie gets way lighter after that. It becomes like this kind of like, you know, it becomes a much sillier kind of movie after those two scenes.
Yeah,
where definitely. She becomes like this, like she goes to Okinawa and meets you know, Hattori Hanzo, played by the great Sonny Chiba, and it has like these like really like comedy moments where Sonny Chiba is bickering with his like with his wait staff, and they're joking around with each other. And
well, you have to kind of explain who Hattori Hanzo is. Hattori Hanzo is a world renowned sword maker who is retired.
Yes.
I don't know if they told the backstory in this, but I did do research in the backstory.
Yes.
So this might explain things too, and I didn't know this. Is in the movie, like Hattori Hanzo like made all these swords, and then he stopped making them all of a sudden, like he retired, and nobody knows why. And he opened up a sushi restaurant in Okinawa. Now, also in Japanese culture, Okinawa is known for one of the worst places to get sushi. So why he like. reinvents himself as like a sushi chef in like Okinawa. But anyway, that's I think part of the running joke of the whole thing. But
that he's not good at it.
Yeah, that he's not good, you know, and it's also like a second, you know, sort of career choice for him. Because he's really good at like this sword making thing, right? So but one of the reasons why is because he made swords. Well, the story goes that he made swords as like they're just like display. They're just supposed to be like, you know, really to look at, like, you know, just kind of like a trophy kind of thing. And then, but he, like, David Carradine's character, like, Bill, was, you know, getting him to sell it to him. And then he realized that, like, you know, Bill is giving them to his assassin squad to, like, go kill people. And his swords were being used to actually carry out assassinations. And then that's why he got, like, really mad at Bill. And that's why Uma Thurman's character, or the bride, or whatever, goes to Hattori and convinces her, and she says, "I'm going to go after one of your students.
I need one of your quality tools, basically."
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's just because Tarantino, in these movies, in all his movies, writes backstory for his characters that is never actually shown in the films. Every one of his movies has stuff in the scripts about the history of these characters that you never actually see, but informs their actions.
Right, and it goes right after that into, like, the backstory. Well, I mean, you never get to see that. All you get to see is, like, he blesses the sword as, like, that's going to end all these killings or, like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's an homage to samurai films. Mm-hmm. That's very much out of what they call Schomburg films, which are samurai movies.
Right.
Like, how it's almost a very religious kind of experience. Yeah, you know, the swords in that culture are almost holy.
Well, you don't get them until you are a samurai,
yes.
Right? Like, they're like it's bestowed upon you,
yeah.
You know, whatever. Yeah,
and you treat it with respect. It becomes it's meant to be an extension of who you are,
right?
You know, and so she, yeah, but again, it goes from these very serious scenes in the beginning to this kind of lighthearted scene where she goes to meet Hattori Hanzo, and she's not admitting who she is. He's not admitting who he is. They're kind of bantering, and it's playful. Mm-hmm. And it kind of lifts you up from those earlier, like, dark scenes.
Yeah.
And to me, those scenes are really light and fun. And then it kind of segues right into the end of the film. The other thing I find interesting about watching Kill Bill Volume 1 is how little actually happens in it.
Yeah.
Like, you have, you know...
That's, I think, another one of Quentin Tarantino's things. I mean, there's not... I mean, somebody even said in, like, one of the reviews that I read, and I'm not going to bring this up at the end, is, like... You don't really get a lot of the main character's story. You get everybody else's story,
yes.
Right? Yeah, everybody that she kills, essentially. Yeah. So, no, it goes into a whole animation scene about...
Oren Ishii.
Say it again. Say it one more time.
Oren Ishii.
Oren Ishii, played by Lucy Liu.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes into her, like, backstory and, like, how
and
she became...
And it's like an anime,
Right, and it's done, like, this anime kind of thing and how, like, she became into power and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, how she became, like, the head of the Japanese mafia. And she gets more backstory than any other character in the entire movie does.
Right, yeah, I think
And she's kind of like the big final boss of the first film.
Right.
You know, but really, the movie has very little actual plot. Other than you have fight scene at the beginning, the bride waking up, bride gets her sword, bride goes and fights Oren Ishii.
Mm.
And that's kind of the movie. And,
right.
And where it sings and where it comes alive and where it's fun is in the details.
Well, let's talk about the Oren Ishii fight. Let's talk about...
The House of Blue Leaves. Yeah.
The House of Blue Leaves. It's like Japanese sort of like...
Rock club kind of.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Like, it's like, and I love is when the bride is flying into Japan, she literally has her sword next to her on the plane. It's one of those hyper-realistic things that only Tarantino could get away with. She literally has her sword on the plane, and then when he pans out a little bit, you realize every other passenger has a samurai sword with them, too, for some reason.
Well, I mean, all of it is, like, unrealistic. Like,
yeah.
How she just wakes up from a coma, she can use her arms and legs and her head, but she can't use her legs, like... okay.
Like,
so, because she can beat everybody's, you know, behind with her arms, basically, but then, like, can't use her legs. And then in 12 hours, all of a sudden, she can use her legs.
Okay.
Right. And then, also, she can just walk out of the hospital with, you know, nobody thinks any wiser.
Yeah.
And she's in a coma, not hooked up to a feeding tube, not hooked up to a breathing tube. Like, she's just, like, sleeping.
Yeah.
Like, because, no, that doesn't happen.
Because those kind of movies didn't pay attention to those kind of details, and kind of homaging that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah,
and you're right. It's kind of tongue in cheek. I mean, it's treated seriously, but you're meant to kind of like laugh with it a little bit. And when she's flying in, like the shots of Tokyo.
Well, I mean, even like, you know, what was the guy's name? The hospital guy. Like his
Buck.
Name was Buck. Because I like to, you know,
yeah,
you know, and. Yeah, that sort of thing. And the name of his truck was like the Pussy Wagon.
Yeah, it's all very 70s exploitation movie kind of stuff. But like I was saying, when she's flying in Japan, like the shots of Japan getting closer with the plane are obviously like a set.
Yeah.
So it's like a model. It's like a Godzilla movie. And when she goes up in Japan, she's immediately dressed like Bruce Lee in Game of Death. She's got the yellow suit on with the black streak.
Well, I mean, all of the... Like the posters and all that kind of stuff. We're all like yellow with her in the yellow motorcycle suit.
So she goes to this rock club called the House of Blue Leaves where Oren Ishii and her gang the crazy 88s, who all dress like Kato, speaking of other characters, dress like Bruce Lee.
Yeah, Branson.
Where they all hang out and basically run the joint.
Right.
And it's this set is so cool. It's like this big bamboo, like, design club. There's, like, this great, like, surf rock band playing called the 5678s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a cool set. It's also a really big set. Like, this place looks like it's two stories. It looks really wide and tall.
Yeah.
And they basically have this huge, like, multi-man sword battle as the bride...
That's, like, ridiculous.
As the bride tries to get to Orenishi, she basically cuts her way through the crazy 88.
Well, what happens, like, all the badasses or whatever, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. that are, like, her entourage that she's with, they all come down. And there's probably, what, about six or eight of them?
Six or seven, yeah.
But anyway, I mean, the first thing she does is she cuts off the arm of the lawyer lady of Julie Dreyfus.
Basically, like the administrative assistant for the Deadly Viper squad, apparently, like their secretary or some.
Right. No, she was the lawyer. That's what
she was like basically like their administrative person. Yeah.
Well, I mean, every good gangster has to have a good lawyer, right?
It's true.
So,
like
so she's like the lawyer who like cleans up all their messes, right?
She's like the Robert Duvall character for Bill, but since this is a Tarantino movie, she's a very sexy character,
Her name's Sophie, played by Julie Dreyfus. Now, not Julia Louise Dreyfus.
No, different character, yeah. Right. Julie Dreyfus was a French actress who was in a lot of Tarantino's films, actually.
Yeah, so, confidant, she's like second lieutenant. But yeah, like cuts her arm off, off.
And like blood sprays from it like a fountain.
It's like somebody turn on like the blood faucet. I mean, there's no like pulsing. No, it's just like...
It's like a hose.
Yeah. It's very cartoony.
Yeah. And that's another homage to a certain type of samurai films from like the 70s.
Right.
Like Lone Wolf and Cub was real big about that, where you get cut, like blood would just spray.
Yeah.
Like it's just like a fire hose of like red water.
Yeah. And then there was, so she cuts her way through all of like the badasses, and then she finally gets to the bodyguard. Gogo, what is her name?
Gogo Yabari.
Gogo Yabari.
Who's like a Japanese schoolgirl.
Yeah, Chaki.
I am terrible with Japanese names.
Chaki Kuriyama. If I messed up your name.
Yeah. She's one of the stars of the Japanese cult classic Battle Royale,
mm-hmm.
which is a very popular Japanese film.
Right.
She plays a very similar character in that movie.
Right.
She's basically like a psychotic schoolgirl.
Right. And go back, and she has that like ball on the chain and all this other kind of stuff, and you're like, wow, that was really badass, like all this stuff is like really badass, and you're just like, okay, it's gonna be over, like now she's gonna have like the sword fight with Orenishi, and it's like no,
like 40 more crazy 88s show up.
You hear all these cars like driving up and like, and you think like, what are the cops here or something like that, or
there's
like,
no police in this world.
No, there is not. It's,
there's like, only kung fu.
Oh yeah, the only people like I saw were like the Texas Rangers that were like,
right. There's two cops in this entire world, and they're in Texas, so that they're busy.
Yeah, they're busy. They're wearing their sunglasses and going, "Yeah, this is bad. Yep, you know, whatever."
Yeah,
but so there's no law like going on anywhere.
No.
So, they finally all these other people show up like out of nowhere, and you're just like.
And the fight keeps going.
Yeah, the fight just like, you think it's like to a stopping point. You're like, oh, wow, that was really cool. Okay. Then like when everybody just showed up and I just sat back in my chair and I was like, okay, this is just ridiculous now.
And I think what it was Tarantino obviously likes kung fu movies. He likes samurai films. He had always wanted to do one. He felt like he's really excited to finally get to play with fight choreography. Like he just went hog wild with fight choreography because he got a chance to do it finally.
Yeah.
Like, he was super excited to do it. Like, I could just see him sitting by the camera, like, grinning like an idiot while he's filming all these cool people fighting each other.
That's just the way Tarantino is. I mean, anything that he does is just like, it's like way over the top, and then he has to go over the top again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's just like, oh, this is how here's how we're topping all these other movies that have been done. Now we're going to take it to the next level. It's kind of like who is that guy? Emeril. He's like, oh, we're going to
kick
it up a notch. Yeah.
I always think of it as Tarantino's movies are like how you remember the movies he's referencing. They're not like the movies he's referencing, but they're how your mind remembers them. Like, you always remember things being crazier than they actually are.
Yeah.
So I think that his movies are like how you remember kung fu movies being when you think about them in your head.
Right.
You know, crazy violent, crazy long fight scenes. But and here they actually are
three people at once, five people at once, like being on top of a, you know, the railing of the balcony, you know, sword fighting and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Everything looks cool. Everyone has cool lines to say.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, the silhouette scene was like really, really cool. I really like that part.
Where they're like, we're like silhouetted against like this blue wall and you see the outlines and Well, she does that again in Volume 2, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
But that's, again, that's a very much a martial arts movie thing for just that striking iconography and just where looking cool is more important than logic.
But everything in there just happens so fast. It's hard to me. I think it's like one of those things. It's like it's hard to appreciate every little bit of it. Like I want to appreciate some of it, but it's just like and in another sense, you're like you also don't want to like overanalyze it really because it's really just like wrapped up in a bunch of like ridiculous, like never going to happen land either. So, you know, you just kind of accept it and go, wow, you know.
I was thinking you just let it wash over you and just enjoy it in the moment. And when you go back and watch it again, you'll see other things you missed. And, but then after that big fight scene.
Well, going back to that, I think that's one of the things that people like about kung fu movies too is like, every time you watch it, like, you see, like, different things, even though you know what's going to happen.
Well, in a lot of ways, it's almost like watching ballet, too. It's beautiful movement captured on film.
Right.
I mean, because it is. It's, like, it's beautiful choreography. It's like dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just has this, you know, silly gore on top of it. That's not really realistic. So it's not really gross. It's just, it's kind of silly.
Crazy gore.
Yeah. But then he changes it up because when all those guys are dead and she fights Arunishi, it's, the fight they have is very still.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's very much like a more like a traditional samurai film.
Yeah.
Where there's not a lot of crazy, like, blocks and counters. You know, there's just a few, like, slashes, and then, you know, she basically cuts off the top of Oren's head.
And, opens it like a canister, basically.
Yeah. And it's very subtle compared to what came before. So the rhythm of it to me is interesting. Like, you have this crazy, excessive fight scene, and you have this very subtle, quiet fight scene right afterwards.
Well, that fight scene to me, instead of just like wrapped up in all this, like, I don't know, fury of just like action, he actually built some tension in there. Like the tension with the bamboo fountain and stuff like that. Like, that was like, you know, when I saw that, it just like draws you in.
Yeah.
Because there's like a fountain, and basically it's like, it just like hits every so often.
That rhythm. It creates
that rhythm. And it's just, you know, because they're taking a pause because like Orianishi got like hit by the knee or something like that. And they're like talking like, do you really want to go through with this? Like, do you have any fight left? Blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so they're having a little bit of a, you know, sparring dialogue in between them. But it's just like, because even when, the bride, you know, even when she gets like slashed, you know, like Orinishi doesn't go take him. It's like they're taking honor in their fighting. Like, okay, I'm not just going to use this slight little brazing to take you down. Like, if we're going to fight, we're going to fight for real, you know?
And to me, it's a little more realistic to how sword fighting is with samurai swords. Because if you look at kendo or those kinds of arts, sword fighting with samurai swords is deadly. Like, you watch old samurai films like the ones by Kurosawa or the Zatoichi series, to be really nerdy, a lot of those fight scenes weren't long. They were usually very, very quick. Because it'd be almost like a gunfight, like a quick draw contest where, like, the bad guy would slash, the hero would slash, they maybe slash one or two more times, but then someone would die. It'd be like 3 seconds or 5 seconds, and then the bad guy would go down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what he's homaging there. So he had, like, his crazy, like, excessive version of that, and then he did something. He wanted to show the different styles of martial arts you could show in films.
Well, I just liked how they, you know, it was done like I said, like honorably. You know what I mean? Like, they're not like they were taking honor, and and to me that is giving homage to like the actual like martial arts of it all. You know,
and it's also beautiful to look at. It's probably the prettiest part of the entire movie.
Yeah, it's shot like in the. It's like in the. It's like kind of in the backyard, kind of where it's snowing. There's
it's
like snowing.
It's beautiful, and it's nighttime. It's just, it's gorgeous looking.
Yeah.
Like, Lucy Liu's wearing this beautiful white kimono, and it's just, everything just seems elegant. You have this violence juxtaposed with this elegance.
And then the when she gets her head cut off, like the blood against the snow, you know,
just sort gently of the, splatters the snow like a little streak, and it's artful.
Yeah,
it really is, and it's just it's so much so much restraint compared to what we just saw, you know, 10 minutes earlier.
Right. So, and then that just leads into, I think, the closing line of, like,
yeah,
volume one was...
The big cliffhanger.
Yeah, the big cliffhanger. Does she know the baby isn't dead?
Or no, does she know her daughter's alive?
Her daughter's alive,
yeah.
Same thing. Yeah, but and that's a better line.
Then cut to credits. And I remember seeing that in the theater, and people literally gasped.
Right.
Because no one knew. Spoilers weren't really a big thing back then.
Right. But if you think about it, you're like, oh yeah. I mean, I guess you can. A woman having a coma, you know, she's still alive. Like, yeah, she still can have her gestation period, can still carry out just like normal.
And
like,
she was She was pretty far along when it happened. Which she's very pregnant in that scene.
Yeah, like 6 months or something like that. Yeah.
But yeah, people gasped in the theater, and they were upset that it ended on such a dramatic cliffhanger. Like, they wanted to see what happened immediately. I remember that very clearly.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching it going like, oh, crap, where is this going now? You know, you want to know, like, what is actually happening? Like, what's going to happen? When is she going to find out before she meets Bill or all this other stuff? So all these things go through your head. And I can't imagine having to wait a year to see the sequel part.
And no one really knew what it was going to be like. We kind of all thought it'd be, like, more of the same. And what's brilliant about this movie, what's brilliant about Tarantino, is it's not really the same kind of movie.
No.
Which leads us, I think, into
Volume 2.
Volume 2.
So I'll read the synopsis right quick of Volume 2. The murderous bride... Take 2. Volume 2. The murderous bride is back, and she is still continuing her vengeance quest against her ex-boss, Bill, and taking aim at Bill's younger brother, Bud, and Ellie Driver, the only survivors from the squad assassins who betrayed her 4 years earlier. It's all leading up to the ultimate confrontation with Bill, the bride's former master, and the man who ordered her execution. That was written by Anthony Pieria.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you, Anthony. So, yeah, so kind of continues on. Now, we didn't mention Ellie Driver.
Played by the great Daryl Hannah.
Oh, Hannah. I like Daryl Hannah as an actress.
Yeah.
Her character was so great. I could not stand Daryl Hannah.
She's kind of like the evil version of Uma Thurman.
Yes. She's like the antithesis or like the evil Uma Thurman.
Yeah. She's like, it's like Superman and Bizarro Superman in a way. Yeah.
Right. But she has like, where she has like short hair. Like, you know, Daryl has long blonde hair, you know.
And Daryl Hannah's got this great iconic eye patch that she has. It's always color coordinated with whatever she's wearing at the time.
Right.
And she's always smoking, which is such a cool, like, villain thing, you know?
Yeah, but she is, like, so ruthless.
Yeah.
Like, so ruthless. You see her in Volume 1. You only really get to see her because she shows up. They find out where she's at, and she was going to inject some sort of serum into her IV that was going to kill her. But then Bill calls at the last minute to hold it off.
And he's just like, leave her be. She suffered enough, yeah.
Right.
And so that's really the only time you really see her, Daryl Hannah is a character, Elle Driver, in the first film. But in this next film, she's one of the main villains in Volume 2.
And I also didn't mention, so it was also Bud. So Bud is technically like Bill's brother.
Yes, played by Michael Madsen from Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, who plays this like sort of like desert rat, you know, bouncer guy.
He's kind of this
guy.
Drunk and trying to become a drunken loser after all this stuff went down.
Well, if you live in the desert, okay, for people that live like that, just like live in a trailer out in the desert somewhere, they are referred to as desert rats.
Hmm.
So, like, Dick Dale apparently was like a big desert rat.
Really?
Yeah, Dick Dale, the surf guitar guy.
I know Dick Dale.
Yeah. So, but anyway, that's kind of, it's not a derogatory term.
No.
It just means that, you know, you don't like really, you kind of like more on the fringe of society. You know, not really, like, kind of participating, like, you know, you kind of want to escape, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of an off-the-grid kind of person.
Yeah, definitely.
And the movie implies that Bud was kind of overcome with guilt about what happened, and he broke away from the assassination group and kind of went his own way, and
even had a story that he told Bill in the second one that he sold his sword.
Yeah, he got rid of his sword. He didn't need it anymore.
Sold it to a pawn shop for like $350.
Yeah, and Bill's like, you pawned your Hanzo sword? That thing was priceless. And I love Bud's response. He's like, priceless. Worth about $250.
It's price of whatever somebody's going to pay for it, right?
Yeah.
So you kind of get the idea that he just does whatever he can for money.
Yeah.
You know?
And so the movie kind of opens on Volume 2 with Beatrice, with the bride, driving to confront Bill. And then it flashes back to her trying to take out Bud.
Well, she, you know, if you remember in Volume 1, she, what's her name? Kiddo, the bride, mm-hmm. you know, spares the lawyer, you know, spares her life, puts her in the trunk of her own car, drives her off, and then basically sends her with a message and says, tell Bill I'm coming after him, basically. And, you know, all these people are dying because of revenge. So that's what prompted basically Bill to go to his brother and be like, hey, man. Get ready. She's alive and she's going to come kill you. So you better have that sword ready. Yeah. And he's like, no, I sold it.
Yeah, but it's like, I'm not worried about it.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, I'll be all right. So anyway, she sneaks up on him and then he kind of gets the better hand.
Yeah, he gets the drop on her, you know, just by chance and buries her alive.
Yeah.
Which again is another exploitation kind of thing.
Right.
And you're thinking, how is she going to get out of this? Because I mean, she's tied up. She's buried alive. How is she going to survive? But then it cuts to another thing about her past. You see how she learned Kung Fu.
So she learns Kung Fu from martial arts master Pai Mei.
Who is also played by Gordon Liu, who played the leader of the Crazy 88s in the first volume.
So, but you told me something in the pre-production that I didn't realize about Pai Mei is not really like a character that's strictly known to kill Bill, right?
No. There's easily 5-10 movies, maybe even 15, about the Pai Mei character in Hong Kong cinema. He's kind of a classic villain in Hong Kong movies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, oftentimes, it's actually played by Gordon Liu, who plays him here in Kill Bill. So I kind of use Surface Support. It's kind of like if Tarantino had put the Lone Ranger in this movie. That's kind of the status of a Pai Mei in China.
And you know what he looks like? He's got the gray hair. He's got the Fu Manchu, like the gray Fu Manchu.
Yeah,
very
typical, like Shaw Brothers, like villain.
Yeah.
Kung Fu movie villain.
So, and yeah, and there's like that whole like three-inch punch or whatever where it's like the hand and like they got a punch through the board.
And basically you get this whole like classic like Kung Fu movie training sequence with the bride learning Kung Fu from this old Kung Fu master. And he teaches her like the old cliche of the 1-inch or 3-inch punch.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and what I love about this little Kung Fu training sequence is the detail of it looks so much like an old Kung Fu movie. Like the way they do the zooms, the way they do the rear projection screens when they're doing their forms,
mm-hmm.
the way he laughs and flips his beard, all that stuff is taken verbatim from those old movies. And I love it because all the love of that genre is apparent in every moment of that mm-hmm. sequence.
Yeah. That's, I mean, and even though that Volume 2 is more like a Western,
yeah.
that's still like more the homage to the Kung Fu-ness, right?
I think that was the one thing that he couldn't really put in the first film because he wanted you to have tension to think she was caught when she was buried alive. But by seeing her learning that technique of how to punch from short distances, she basically busts her way out of the coffin and digs her way out.
And here's the weird thing. Like, in the first film, she's basically like, doesn't miss a beat hardly. You know what I mean? Like, I think the guy, Gordon Liu, the guy that played, he played both Johnny Mo and Master Pai Mei.
Yeah.
But when he played Johnny Mo and he was one of the crazy 88s, like, he gets a few punches in her and she, you know, I mean, she's not perfect, right?
Yeah.
Even like the go-go kind of, you know, gets a better hand of her like once or twice. But what I'm saying is like, she still carries on like she's such a badass.
Yeah.
And then when she, you know, when Bud gets the drop on her and then gets buried, you're just like, wait, what is happening here? This is a totally different.
It just subverts what she thinks is going to happen.
Right. And it almost seems like it's a totally different character. It seems like a totally different movie.
Yeah.
You're just like, wait. And then you think, but wait. We still got to get to the end. I know this has to happen.
Yeah. We know she survives. How does she survive?
How does she get out of this? Yeah. So that's what I think makes those scenes and that whole, like, sort of backstory that you know, flashback, like, so poignant, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and they're fun, and you're right, but they're really emotional because the score is really good in those sequences, too, and it's really triumphant when she gets out, and then when she goes back to deal with Bud, she sees that Daryl Hannah's character, L. Driver, is also there to buy Kiddo's Hanzo sword off of Bud.
Well, Bud now realizes, like, hey, she's buried. Now I really don't have to have the sword. You know what I mean? Because the only person that's really going to come after me is probably her.
Yeah.
So I don't need the sword anymore. If it's really that priceless, I can probably get a lot of money for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sells it off to, you know,
Daryl Hannah's character.
Daryl Hannah for $1 million.
Yeah. And so she shows up at the trailer, and
Daryl Hannah's like, no, I'm just going to kill you.
Yeah, and double crosses Bill. And why does she double cross Bill? Because she's mad that he got the drop on the bride. She respected the bride. That's another Kung Fu movie thing. She respected the bride enough where she wanted to face her in combat, and she was mad that she was never going to get the chance because Bud got lucky.
Yeah, that she got to her before, you know, she did. But, yeah, or he got to her before.
I love that. I love the way he kind of works in those Kung Fu movie tropes into this other kind of story. And she basically kills Bud by having him bitten by a snake, which is that's a brutal death, too, when he gets bitten by the snake to make it look like it was a trap by the bride.
Yeah.
And it's all in this little dingy trailer.
Yeah.
It's all dusty and gross looking. And then she has this great, like, close quarters fight with the bride where they're trying to pull the sword out, but there's no room to get the sword out of the sheath. Mm-hmm. And they're going back and forth. And she knocks the bride into Bud's bedroom. And she sees Bud's Hanzo sword. Turns out he didn't sell it. And she pulls that out, and she has a sword fight with L.
Yeah.
There in the trailer. And I love this little line where when the bride's got the sword out, L sees it and he goes, "Is that Bud's Hanzo sword?"
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, "Yep. He told me he sold it." Well, I guess that makes him a liar, don't it? and I love that. So, that's a very Tarantino line.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way Tarantino talks.
Yeah.
One thing I love about Tarantino's dialogue, after I've seen a bunch of interviews with him,
uh-huh,
I can hear bits of his speech in his characters.
Okay,
and that phrase is very much a Tarantino phrase, and it makes me laugh every time.
Yeah. Because you could easily just say, well, I guess he's a liar. But, I mean, he has to add the, like, well, I guess that makes him a liar, don't it? You know, it's like...
Yeah.
Who would come up with that or write
that's
that
kind
in
of a little bit of
dialogue.
A Southern thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cheeky and I just love it. But then we come across and they have this really brief little sword fight and then another piece of really nasty gore as the bride plucks out L. Driver's good eye.
Well, wait a second. Let's back up a second.
Okay.
Let's explore the characters of, like, L and B? Beatrix and B or Beatrix for a second.
Yeah.
So when David Carradine, when Bill brings, like, you know, Beatrix to get trained by this Master Pai Mei,
mm-hmm,
one of the things he talks about in, like, this whole flashback is, like, Pai Mei hates Americans, he hates blonde Americans, he hates, like, all these things. And,
hates,
like,
women.
He hates women. And he's like, you know, because he thinks that they're, you know, whiny and they're not going to work as hard and they're, you know, they're not going to listen to him and they're not going to respect him and all this other kind of stuff. But he agreed to, like, take her on anyway. Well, I mean, you learn in the first one that, like, that really, like, you know, Daryl Hannah character or Elle, she's basically the new girlfriend since.
Like Bill's got a type.
Yeah, right.
Tall, like, blondes, yeah.
This is Bill's new gal, right? So he does the same thing. He's like, okay, we'll take you up to Pai Mei, get trained.
Yeah.
And, you know, you find out that, like, he like plucked out her eye because
she was rude.
Yeah, yeah, she was rude and disrespected him.
Yeah.
So for that, like, she poisoned him and killed him.
And another kung fu movie trope, and she goes, "That's right, I killed your master." You know.
Right. And it's just like, so what does she do? She basically plucks out her other eye, yeah, like, and revenge, yeah,
and leaves her blind, flailing around this dirty trailer in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't even bother killing her.
Yeah, does it? That was the one thing that I thought was weird. I'm like, I mean, she might come back and get revenge on her some other way or like whatever. Because I guess she figured if she's blind, like, you know, like I
thought she really hated her and wanted to be especially cruel.
Well, one of the other scenes like had a snake like still wandering around.
Yeah.
So you kind of get the idea that like
maybe she thought the snake would get her.
Yeah, maybe because here's the other thing: Uma Thurman is actually known as the Black Mamba, and there was a black, like the snakes that she that Elle used,
yes,
to kill Bud were Black Mamba snakes.
Yeah, because he wanted it to look like Beatrice had done it. Right, and yeah,
so you kind of get the idea is like she's just going to flail around and then, you know, because there was, yeah, she released like three snakes in that thing.
I think it was just the one, but I mean, it's it seems that it bites Bud like four times, so it seems like there's more of them. Mm-hmm. But after that scene, we again, the movie kind of shifts as she goes to confront Bill.
Right.
And she goes to Bill, and was it, she think they're going to have this like great big like knockdown like kung fu fight? But when she gets to Bill's home in Mexico, the first thing she sees is Bill playing with her daughter.
Right. Now, granted the fact that Kill Bill Volume 1 was like, what, an hour and 45 minutes?
2 hours.
Yeah.
Or an hour and 55, I believe, maybe.
Kill Bill Volume 2 is like 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So the last scene is only like half an hour.
Yeah.
So we left Volume 1 with the daughter.
Yeah.
And you're basically a whole hour and a half into this film.
Waiting for
an hour and 45 minutes of this film. We still don't know anything about this daughter.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You still don't know. She has to go see, like, Bill's, like...
like, surrogate father to find out where he lives.
Find out where he lives.
Also played by Michael Parks. Yeah. But anyway, so she gets to Bill's, and she sees Bill playing with her daughter, and it's like a revelation. Like, this little girl, whose name is Bebe, is adorable. Like, it's just a little angel of a kid.
Oh, I know. The cutest little girl. Yeah.
So I got to ask you, you talked about how the first movie affected you as a parent. How did this stuff affect you as a parent?
I mean, that's... how they treated her. I mean, I thought it was bad that, you know, her dad's going to get killed or whatever. And I just hoped that it was the same thing. Like, she's not going to come down and see. Mm. And there's still, like, this whole idea of, like, how is she going to explain that? Like,
yeah,
she had to, David Kinder, Bill had to explain, like, you know, your mommy was sleeping, but she's been dreaming about you or whatever. Yeah. But now she's going to have to explain to Bebe, like, well, your dad's not coming back, you know, because Bill is like the child's father, technically. Yes.
And he's very honest with the kid in a way. He's like, you know, mommy made daddy mad, so daddy shot mommy, and he shouldn't have done that. But when he did, she slept for a very long time.
Right.
And he's saying this while he's making her a sandwich.
Yeah, you know? I know.
Like, it's like this little weird like domestic scene.
Right. Yeah, and the whole truth serum and the talk and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, but the scenes with the little girl, I thought were like, you know, that was just meant to like really tug at your heartstrings.
And it's really good. It shows what Tarantino is, a very versatile filmmaker. Like when they tuck the kid in and Uma Thurman lays down with the kid and they watch a video.
Yeah.
And they watch a Lone Wolf and Cub movie, by the way.
Right.
That's the reference to that. Yeah. Which is about a samurai and his child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all very sweet, though. Like, it's very almost like a drama,
right,
about a family. But then after the kid falls asleep, she gets up and she goes to confront Bill. And he basically talks about, before their fight, how she could never be this non-killer. He was always meant to be a killer, and he felt hurt and dejected that she would try to pretend to be someone that was ordinary. And he compared her to Superman. And I love his Superman speech.
Yeah, I always love... this is another, like, kind of Tarantino kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's always some, like, long soliloquy joke, or there is always some long, like, discussion. Like, in Pulp Fiction, there was, like, the talk of, like, It's always some weird, odd conversation.
About something, like, about pop culture.
Something about pop culture. Like, they talked about, you know, McDonald's.
Yes.
You know, and like, you know what they call, you know, Big Mac and McDonald's a Royale with cheese and all this other kind of stuff.
And that they talked about, like, you know, the Fantastic Four and Reservoir Dogs. You know, they talked about how they got to look like the thing from the Fantastic Four.
Right. There's always some weird thing. And in this one, but I love how he wove it into the story. And it's something that I never really thought about either.
Yeah.
Was the fact that Superman was always Superman, and he had to, his disguise was Clark Kent. Like, that was his costume.
That was his commentary on humanity.
Right, exactly. And basically making the idea, like, you were a killer, you're really a killer, but you were pretending, you know, to be this ordinary
person. You're Superman, you're not Clark Kent, and I won't let you be Clark Kent.
Right. And then decided to take revenge on her because, you know, he overreacted or whatever. Yeah. You know, I thought that was hilarious, too.
Was and he's like, yeah, I overreacted. He goes, you think? and then when they go to fight, their fight is very quick. She, again, and they break out another martial arts movie trope where she kills him with a secret technique that was referenced earlier in the film that Pai Mei knew, that he never taught to Bill. And when she does it to Bill, Bill is shocked. He's like, Pai Mei taught you that technique?
Well, that was the whole thing. Like, they knew Pai Mei knew how to do it, but he didn't teach anybody. Or nobody that they knew, like, said, no, he didn't teach it to me. Or he didn't teach it to me.
Yeah.
But he taught it to her because...
Because he knew she was a good person.
Right. Yeah, he only taught it to, like, his top students or, like, whatever.
But I always think that he kind of knew in his heart she was worthy of it. Like, she was good.
Right.
And I love how it has this trope of this kung fu movie thing that's ridiculous, like, technique that kills you instantly, but their reactions to it are so real. And, like, he's shocked. He's like, Pai Mei taught you that technique? And she's nearly bawling, and she just nods. Like, she's fighting back the urge to sob. And she goes, of course he did. Yeah. And her acting is so good. It's such a ridiculous scene, but she's so real and honest. And her emotions are so naked in that moment. It's beautiful. Like, she's so good in that moment. And he basically gets up, kind of straightens his jacket, walks off, and dies within a few steps.
I also, just going back really quickly, the conversation between Al and Bud was also really good.
Yes.
Because... L, like, being like, you know, L to her, like, basically, like, Bill is, you know, is Beatrix's enemy, right?
Yeah.
So to L, Beatrix is her enemy.
Yes.
So, like, Bud asks her a question, like, are you going to be relieved or are you going to be
full of regret?
Full of regret, like, once, you know, now that you know all this is over or whatever. Yeah. And it's the same sort of thing, like, when that happens, when he, you know, falls to the ground and all this kind of stuff, like, that conversation, you know, plays in your head because it's like, now it's all over.
Yeah.
Like, the name of the movie is Kill Bill. Bill is dead. Bill has been killed. Yeah. What do you do now? Like, are you going
to
be filled with
And that's one of the interesting things about it, because then it cuts to the next morning.
Right.
And you see BB in a hotel room somewhere watching cartoons, being a cute little kid. And you don't see Beatrix. And then they cut to the bathroom, and she's literally on the ground sobbing in the bathroom, like, literally crying her eyes out. But her crying slowly becomes a laugh because she's realized she got to be free finally. But she's also sad at the same time because she did love Bill. And there's another line I love about her competition with David Carradine. And they're talking about the technique, and she's almost sobbing, and he goes, you never told me that he taught you the technique. And she goes, no, I guess I'm a bad person. And Bill, very dignified, goes, no, you're not a bad person. You're not a terrible person. You're the best person. You're my favorite person. And it's very earnest. And I don't know, I get choked up at that scene. Because you get the idea that he loves her too. Just these characters are trapped in a genre movie. So they kind of have to be genre characters.
Okay.
They're like real people trapped in a genre movie.
Right.
It's weirdly nuanced.
Yeah.
Like, the first movie is a little more flashy. The second one's really nuanced.
It is. There's a lot of, you know, conversations. There's a lot of real moments. There's a lot of stuff. I mean, the Western part, like, the whole, you know, thing out that happens in the desert. I mean, that's all the western-y part.
Yeah.
Also, the shooting up in the church and all that kind of stuff.
Is if you didn't mention that, Sam Jackson's in the movie.
Yeah, Samuel L. Jackson plays the organist.
In the church, he gets a funny little scene where he gets to ask him what their favorite song is.
Yeah.
It's always good to see Sam Jackson.
Yeah. But that's one of the things I wanted to mention. Like, you know, all in another thing about Quentin Tarantino, about how good he is and about how I think he's just like, he's so good at visually telling a story. And as much as we talk about the characters, and one of the reasons that we get wrapped up in the characters, and one of the reasons that we, you know, we're sitting here talking about the movie, and we're sitting here explaining it, is because it ties you in and it brings you in.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's those visual scenes. It's the cast and the casting. That's one of the things I was trying to get to. The casting is so just like perfect.
And it's people you wouldn't think of.
Right. Like, who would think of Daryl Hannah being such an awesome, you know, villain? Like
Kung Fu assassin with an eye patch. Yeah.
Right. I can definitely see Michael Madsen like playing the character that he did. I mean, he's just kind of this quiet, you know, badass, like, you know,
haunted kind of drifter.
Yeah, know? Right. You know, that I can't, you know, even Uma Thurman, if you really think about it,
yeah.
I mean, as this like Kung Fu master. She never
did anything like that before.
Right. Yeah. She wasn't an action, you know,
she never really did anything after that either. I mean,
if this was like Universal Pictures, they would cast like Angelina Jolie or something like that. You know what I mean? They wouldn't cast Uma Thurman.
You're right. I mean, and that's why, I mean, Tarantino does that throughout all his films. He has a real interesting way of casting actors that you wouldn't expect. He has the guys he likes to work with, sure, but he casts them in ways that are unique and interesting every time and really serve the story well.
Well, and a lot of actors have turned him down because of that, because they're like, I don't think I can do that, or I don't see myself doing that, or whatever. Yeah. And it's because they don't really feel like whatever that he's asking is challenging, like it's too challenging for them.
Or, you know? Or they don't get it.
Right.
Yeah, like, I don't know if you have this in your notes, but you know, like, David Carradine was not the original choice for Bill.
Yes, I did. I do have that in my notes.
Well, then we'll save that for the bit as a bit of a cliffhanger.
Well, let's just go ahead and get to it then. We've been talking about this too long. But yeah, I mean, just to wrap up the two movies, though, I'm really glad I watched them. The same thing happened when I watched Pulp Fiction. Same thing happened when I watched Jackie Brown. Same thing happened when I watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You don't really, you may not get it. A lot of people that I talk to, like, who say, like, I watched a Tarantino film and I didn't really get it. And it's just like, it's one of those films that it's not going to hit you over the head that you're just like going to get right away. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that like those visuals are going to play in your head and that dialogue is going to play in your head. And then like all you're just going to think about it for the next week.
Yes.
And it's just going to, you're just think about it and think about it and be like, wow, like, oh, you know,
it grows on you. It really does. It
really does. It's like one of those, you know, you have a favorite artist of a band and they come up with a new record that has a little bit of a different sound, and you listen to it for the first time, and you're like, meh.
Yeah. And you got to remember.
And then after that, like, you just go walking around, and then, like, one of those songs will just, like, pop in your head, and you're just like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, then, like, you're like, maybe I'll give this a second listen, and then, you know, eventually, like, a month, you're like, this is, like, the best album ever. Yeah.
And that's a good analogy, because Kill Bill at the time was nothing like anything he had done before.
Oh.
Yeah, it was you know, colorful and crazy and a lot louder and more extreme than his other previous three films. That's a great analogy. Yeah,
yeah. I mean he just does what he wants and he does what he has passion for.
Yeah,
and his movies that he has passion for. So you can't really pigeonhole him for a certain type of movie.
No, you really can't.
All right, so let's go into the facts. You also know this. Writer-director Quentin Tarantino and actress Uma Thurman conceived of the bride character and her revenge path during the production of 1994's Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The credits, the film credits the story to Q and U, meaning...
Which is adorable.
Quentin and Uma, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they had to delay the film because he did Jackie Brown and then, like, Uma got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway. According to Uma Thurman, Quentin had her watch three movies in preparation for this film. You want to guess what they are?
I'm going to guess one of them.
Okay.
Lady Snowblood?
No.
Okay.
John Woo's The Killer.
Which, it's funny because, you know, John Woo's The Killer is one of my favorite films. I've seen it easily 25 times.
Wow. Coffee?
Coffee's with Pam Grier. Great movie.
C-O-F-F-Y.
Yeah.
Yeah, starring Jackie Brown.
Blaxploitation at its
Pam
best.
Grier, yeah. Yeah, starring Jackie Brown star Pam Grier. Yeah. And Sergio Leone's A Fistful of Dollars.
And you know what? Those three would be great recommendations for this episode. Those are three amazing movies.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, one made in 89, one made in 73, and one made in 64. I mean, you got one from each, like, decade.
Basically. Yeah, those are, yeah, I mean, and for, yeah, those are, and they're definitely three periods of, like, badass movies.
Yeah. Tarantino did not come to the realization that the bride's child could still be alive until the last 4 or 5 months of the writing process. So he thought of that, like, real plot twist or whatever.
And it makes the film, in my opinion.
I think it really brings, like, a real homage. I mean, like, a real, like, sort of more grand finale. I
to
think.
Me, it gives the movie heart.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Gives that an emotional punch.
Yes. He originally wrote Bill to be played, but here's my note on it. To be played by, do you know who?
Warren Beatty.
Warren Beatty.
Dick Tracy.
But yeah, but he basically, the role required greater screen time and martial arts training, so he rewrote it for David Carradine.
Yeah, I can't imagine Warren Beatty in this movie.
I mean, David Carradine, like Kung Fu, we all know, like the character really was conceived by Bruce Lee.
Yes.
David Carradine kind of carried that out, and I would think, why would he not want David Carradine in the movie? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know why he didn't think of David Carradine first. Like, it seems so obvious to me.
I mean, maybe he wanted to use Warren Beatty in the film for something, or maybe he, you know, met him. I don't know. Anyway, an early draft included a chapter set after the confrontation with Vernita, in which the bride has a gunfight with Gogo Yubari's vengeful sister, Yuki. The scene was cut for time and budget reasons.
See, it would be a little excessive, too. You don't really need another scene like that, you know?
Yeah. He was like, yeah, Gogo's revenge is going to have to get cut because it was going to cost, you know.
But that is the one thing he doesn't really, that's one thing he doesn't really homage is, like, gun violence. Because, you know, a lot of those movies have gun stuff in them, too. And that's one thing Kill Bill is actually missing is, like, you know, like, pistol action.
Another draft featured a scene in which the bride's pussy wagon is blown up by L Driver. And so I read this twice. I found it on two separate sources.
Okay.
One said that, you know, because she mentions that, like, the pussy wagon died or something like that.
Yeah, it died, yeah.
So in one of the sources said that it was blown up by L Driver, and another source said that it was blown up by Gogo's sister, Yuki Yubari. By in that scene, like, Yuki, like, blew up.
I've never read the original script, so I don't know.
No. Anyway, Quentin Tarantino owns the actual pussy wagon.
He does, yeah.
Yeah. He drove it every day to promote the release of the Kill Bill Volume 2. He licensed the use of it for the Missy Elliott music video, I'm Really Hot, and also appears in the video for Telephone by Lady Gaga and Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, look out for those videos. I'm sure they're on YouTube.
They're kind of odd, yeah.
Although the scenes were presented out of chronological order, the film was shot in sequence.
Hmm.
That's another one of the Quentin Tarantino things. He likes to shoot in sequence. Pulp Fiction was shot in sequence. This was shot in sequence. I think Django was shot in sequence.
I guess it'd be harder to keep track of it since the narrative is already fractured.
Yeah.
But it must be easier to keep track of doing it in order and then putting it in the right order in post.
He's known for making a lot of changes, so I think that keeps him on track with the changes.
Yeah, I have read other scripts of his, and yes, they do typically change a lot from script to film.
Right. Yeah, because a lot of times when he sees it or he thinks about it, you know, he makes decisions. Now, I do know another thing about Quentin Tarantino is, like, you don't ad lib anything in the in the script. So even though that he may come up with different stuff, it's not like you get the idea to change it.
No,
if you're the actor, right?
Like, I've heard he gets upset if you don't pause where there are commas.
Oh,
yeah.
The House of Blue Leaves sequence, in which the bride battles dozens of Yakuza soldiers, took 8 weeks to film, and that was 6 weeks over schedule.
It looks like it, yeah.
So they originally thought it was 8 weeks, 6 weeks over schedule. So they really thought that was going to take like 2 weeks to film.
And 2 weeks is a long time by Hollywood standards. But it's actually very similar to how Hong Kong movies do it. Like, Hong Kong movies will shoot fight scenes for weeks and weeks to get them perfect.
Mm-hmm. There were no digital effects in this film. Special effects were traditional practical effects used in 1970s Chinese cinema. The spurts and explosions of blood is created by using fire extinguishers and condoms.
Nice.
Yeah, a condom just meaning a general...
like blood pack. Kind
packet
of
juice.
Yeah.
Meaning like it's just, yeah, like a plastic bag full of like whatever.
Yeah, you rip it open and blood pours out. Yeah,
yeah,
like old packet, school, yeah. Like cheap special effects.
Yeah, but it was like, you know, not just like, oh, I'm going to like, you know, you see them in movies a lot of times where like they'll wear a pack and like somebody gets shot and like you see blood on their shirt or something like that. Like... this is like when Ishii like cuts off the head of that guy. It's just like this fountain of blood coming out of his neck. You know what I mean? Like shooting like 10 foot high.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's like a fire hose. Yeah.
Yeah, you're just like, what in the world? So yeah, I wonder if that's what they do. Like, they're using the fire hose as the propellant.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
Okay. But basically, Tarantino told his crew, let's pretend we're little kids and we're making Super 8 movie in our backyard and you don't have all of this stuff. How would you achieve this effect? Ingenuity is important here. So he was just, you know, very practical effects, very sort of like, you know, kid-like, basically. He just sounds like a kid in a candy store, this guy.
He loves movies, man. He really does.
It was, it took over 450 gallons of fake blood between the two Kill Bill movies.
It looks like, especially in the House of Blue Leaf scene, like literally there's puddles of this red liquid on the floor at the end of the sequence.
I mean, all the fountains were like filled with like blood, and there was so much blood. The shot where the bride splits a baseball bat into two with the samurai sword is done for real on the set. It was done by Zoe Bell, Uma Thurman's stunt double.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like... that was like for real.
Like, she actually cut the baseball in half.
Baseball bat in half.
You mean
baseball.
He throws the baseball and she cuts it. Yeah.
She cuts the baseball in half.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's how sharp and strong the samurai sword is.
Yeah.
And you can watch, there was an episode of Mythbusters where they did a lot of samurai sword myths. And if you get a chance, if you know, have like whatever service. Yeah. And go watch some of those episodes. They're really, really revealing. And you'll be surprised how strong a samurai sword really
is. With the proper techniques, for sure. Like, my father actually studied kendo for several years when I was in high school. And one of the things they learned was how to properly cut. And if you know how to swing a samurai sword properly, you can cut through really thick substances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the little kid. Remember, she cut down the sword of the little kid? Like,
yeah.
They basically said that like that probably couldn't happen, but
no,
yeah. But you're thinking that since he's a youngster, usually the younger ones get like the softer metal or the crappier.
Like he probably had a cheap sword. Yeah.
But anyway, Kill Bill Volume 1 was released in theaters of October 10, 2003. It was the first Tarantino film in 6 years, following Jackie Brown in 1997.
Yeah, it had been a while.
Yeah, there was a long gap.
Yeah.
So, it ranked first at the box office, beating School of Rock, which School of Rock was the second weekend that it was released, and it beat Intolerable Cruelty in its first weekend of release, making Kill Bill Volume 1 the widest theatrical released and highest grossing opening weekend of a Tarantino film to date. And I think that still stands. I don't know if Once Upon a Time
I'd have to look it up, but it probably does, because Kill Bill Volume 1... for the longest time, was his most popular film. It probably still is his most popular film. amongst like everyday people. Like I know people who aren't movie fans who love Kill Bill Volume 1.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Okay. According to the studio exit polls that showed that 90% of the audience was interested in seeing the second Kill Bill after seeing the first.
Well, it ends on that great cliffhanger, yeah.
Yeah.
You leave them wanting more always.
So, I mean, even only 10% of people that left the theater said, nah, I'm not going to watch the second one.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
It is.
Yeah. In the United States, Volume 1 was released on DVD and VHS on April 13th, the week Volume 2 was released. No, so I got that wrong. So it was October, and then of 2003, then in April of 2004.
Yeah.
Kill Bill Volume 2. So it was about 6 months.
Yeah. So I thought that was right. That's how I remembered it. Also, I'm interested that it was released on VHS. It had to be one of the later VHS releases.
Yeah. And it was not released on Laserdisc because it's past 1999.
Mm-hmm.
1999 is a cutoff for Laserdisc for you fans out there like interested in movies and Laserdisc technology.
But VHS didn't last much past 2004. Like, maybe 2 more years after, but anyway, that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, 2004 probably marks the end of VHS. Kill Bill Volume, which I'll have to look up. I wonder if Volume 2 was released on VHS. I'll have to look that up.
Well, while you're reading, I will look that up right now.
Okay. The budget says, like the ones that I saw say $30 million. Now, I do not know if that is a combined $30 million?
You would think it's got to be.
Or if it's like a $60 million and then they just split it in half.
I don't know. I think the whole thing probably costs around 30. Yeah, the whole thing was probably 30.
Yeah, because it was originally intended as one film.
Yeah, and it was put together as one film originally, yeah.
And then the, but it still grossed $180.9 million. So that's quite a success. I mean, considering this is the mid-2000s, and, you know, you're still pulling in close to $200 million, you know, for your film.
I mean, that's a lot.
That is a huge success.
And Kill Bill Volume 2 did come out on VHS.
Did come out on VHS.
So it's still appropriate for this podcast. I was thinking maybe we were violating our own little internal rules. But it came out on videotape, so it's okay.
Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars. Saying Kill Bill Volume 1 shows Quentin Tarantino so effortlessly and brilliantly in command of his technique that he reminds me of a virtuoso violinist racing through the flight of the bumblebee. His story is a distillation of the universe of martial arts movies elevated to a trance-like mastery of the material.
Such a good writer, Ebert.
He writes such good words, but it's hard to say.
Yeah, it's very verbose.
Rotten Tomatoes gave it 85% for critic score, 81% audience.
That's really high.
Yeah. Certified. I don't know if that's certified.
Certified fresh. Yep.
Certified fresh. 85%. I mean, that's really up there, I think.
It's a well-loved movie.
Well-loved movie. Okay. So, did I see? Hold on. All right. I'll have you mention that then. All right, I didn't get them on notes. I'll have you add. I'll let you know.
No worries.
I'll cue you when you're ready.
The behind the scenes stuff right now, okay. Ladies and gentlemen.
All right, the brothel segment where the bride meets with Esteban Vejao. I don't know how to pronounce that. I'm sorry. Was the last scene of the movie to be shot. It was filmed at a Mexican brothel, and all of the female extras were actual prostitutes that worked there.
Hmm.
Okay. At the end of the credits, there is an alternate take of the bride ripping out one of the Crazy 88's eyes.
Yeah.
I wonder if
it's a different angle, yeah.
I wonder if they took that out because they didn't want to reveal, like,
well, no, she, how he was going to take it. She does it in the actual fight. It's just a different camera angle.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lengthy confrontation between Michael J. White and David Carradine were filmed but were cut.
Yeah.
It is the only deleted scene on the Volume 2 DVD.
It's actually, you can find it on YouTube. It's actually a really cool sequence. Again, it looks like a kung fu movie. Michael J. White is this large African-American actor who's known for martial arts movies. He basically confronts Bill while him and the bride are walking through a Chinese market.
Mm.
And he's like, "You killed my master. I must get revenge." And Bill's like, "Well, can't we do this some other time? I'm out with my lady." He's like, "No, we must do it now." And you get to see what a badass Bill is. Like, he fights this guy. He's bigger than him. and defeats him.
Oh, wow.
I think it's meant to make you think that the bride's going to have a really tough fight when she faces Bill.
I see.
So okay. It subverts it when it's not that way.
I see. So it kind of builds you up. But it was I guess, cut because he didn't.
Yeah. I definitely recommend going on Google and looking the scene up. It's a cool little, sequence. Like, it's an entirely finished sequence, and it's really nice. Mm-hmm. The nice little old-school Kung Fu movie homage.
Interesting. Where was I at? You got me so interested in that, I lost my place. That was so cool. At the 2008 Provincetown International Film Festival, Tarantino announced that the original cut of Kill Bill, incorporating both films and an extended animation sequence, would be released in May 2009 as Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair.
And then it never actually happened.
Yeah, so tell us about, that's what I was going to cue you in. Tell us about Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair.
Well, again, the movie was intended to be one film. He had created it as one film and then re-edited it when he was forced to. But he always had his original cut.
Okay. And which is actually like in sequence or whatever.
Well, no, it's just the order is actually different.
Okay.
Some things are shorter, some things are longer, but it's still out of order, but in different ways.
Okay.
Like the movie, like the last parts of the movie are actually the House of Blue Leaves fight, and then it cuts to the Bill fight.
Ah, wow.
Like for example.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
I see.
And people have always wanted to see, because again, it's a different version of the film.
Right.
The footage we haven't seen, it's just different.
Right.
And see, people have always kind of clamored for it. And Tarantino said, I'm going to release it. And then he never really did.
Mm-hmm.
It exists. He shows it at his movie theater, which he owns in L.A., called the New Beverly. They show it about once a year for about a month.
I see. Okay.
They show it like multiple times during that month, but then they put it away. And then they don't show it again until about the same time next year. Never been put on home video. People have seen it and written about it. But if you want to watch it, the only way you can is to go to Quentin Tarantino's theater in L.A. when they show it and buy a ticket.
So, and you can read about it. Like, you haven't seen it yourself,
no.
Right? Okay, because you've never gone to this theater. And
no.
That's the only way to see it at this point. But you've only read about it, basically, the sequence. Now, there's nothing... I want to make sure that everybody's clear. There's nothing added or taken away. It's just in a different sequence.
It's edited differently.
Right.
It's, again, it's some sequences are a little longer. Some are a little shorter. It has the Michael J. White fight scene in it.
Okay.
For example.
Right.
So that is added.
Okay.
But it's just the sequencing is different. It's paced differently. And again, it's more like a condensed version, because if you look at the two movies individually, it's about 4 hours and 12 minutes. His version of the movie, the original version, was a little over 3 hours.
Wow.
So you're losing stuff.
Right.
But I've heard it's good.
Okay.
I've just never saw. I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to see it.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm interested in it. I mean, I would watch it, but yeah, only if it was released. I mean, I can't go out there like a certain time.
No, it's one of my holy grail things. If it came out on video, I would buy it tomorrow, because it's one of my, like, the movies I've always wanted to see, mostly because I can't, you know? The idea is you can't see it makes me want to see it that much more.
It probably won't be released. But it'll probably be released at some point. Okay, so Bill's speech about, we mentioned the talk about Superman.
Mm-hmm.
It was inspired in part by a book called The Great Comic Book Heroes by Jules Feiffer, Feiffer. So if that, you know, interests you, then I would definitely check out that book.
I'm sure you can find it on Amazon.
So that's all the really big notes I have on Volume 2. I mean, the budget also, once again, is $30 million. Box office, $152.2
million. These movies made bank.
Yeah.
They really did.
So going back, so you don't have to rewind... Budget for volume one, or excuse me, box office for volume one was $180.9 million. Volume two, $152.2 million.
I do have one bit of trivia for you.
Okay.
Tarantino has said that him and Uma have an idea for another movie in this universe.
I'm getting there.
I thought you said you were done. I said you didn't have anything else to say about it. Sorry.
Well, of the interesting facts,
okay,
we still have Ebert, Robert, Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, then by all means, continue.
And then any awards, but we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, we'll continue.
Okay. Roger Ebert gave it how many stars?
He gave part two. I'm going to say 4 stars.
Four stars for Roger Ebert.
It's very different, but no less good.
Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill Volume 2, an exuberant celebration of movie making, coasting with heedless joy from one audacious chapter to another, working as irony, working as satire, working as drama, working as pure action. I liked it even more than Kill Bill Volume 1.
I think I've grown to like it more than the first one.
Yeah, I mean, one was like a more like revenge, like just dirty action movie.
Yeah,
and then Volume 2 is more. I mean, it's still kind of a dirty story, but it's
got
like
more meat on the bone.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of the stories and more of the character development of Beatrix, I think. Yeah. All right. Rotten Tomatoes critic score 84%, audience 89%. So just to go back, so once again, you don't have to rewind. Audience score for Kill Bill Volume 1 was 81%.
People love a happy ending.
Right, and the critic score was almost the same. I mean, Volume 1 was 85, Volume 2 was 84.
Yeah.
So, neither film received any Academy Awards. Uma Thurman was nominated twice for Best Actress in the Golden Globes, but she did not win.
Yeah, but sometimes movies, it's not about the awards they win, it's about the cultural impact.
Yeah.
And these movies have had a pretty big lasting cultural impact.
Yeah, they won some British Awards and some Empire Awards and some MTV, video awards. Like, Uma Thurman won for, like, or, like, Best Fight Scene and, you know, that sort of thing. Best performance, that sort of stuff. But then now we're getting to the last part of it. So, and I actually have a direct quote. That's why I wanted you to stop. On a Kill Bill Volume 3, Tarantino's quoted in July of 2019. So that is
recent.
2019.
Yeah,
as saying, "Me and Uma have talked about it recently. And frankly, to tell you the truth, I have thought about it a little further." Okay, where are we going with this, Quentin? "We are talking about it literally last week." All right. Where are we going? "If any of my movies were going to spring from my other movies, it would be a third Kill Bill." So because after he made Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, there were rumors that Quentin Tarantino was basically going to retire.
He said that for a while. That he only wants to make 10 films, and then he's going to move on to other things.
So to even talk about it, to mention kind of a sequel, because he's also said that, like, the lawyer, like Sophie, and also, the daughter.
Yeah, Fernanda Green's daughter.
Yeah, lives. That was kind of like the idea. Yeah, like, yeah, they were going to team.
She grows up, yeah.
Yeah, like, them two were going to team up. Like, and like, she was going to get the other girl to go, like, train, and then, like, they were going to go try to get Uma Thurman.
And that becomes, like, a lot, like an Apocalypse Now kind of thing where they hunt down
the
bride, which I think could be cool.
Yeah.
I mean, Tarantino's are nothing but my complete faith. I'd be there day one.
Right. Because, I mean, Sophie got her arm cut off.
Yeah.
And he's like, Sophie deserves revenge, just like because she was left alive. And so, yeah, so.
Yeah.
I mean, so yeah, I think there's room for a sequel if he wanted to do it.
Yeah. Well, the only thing about Tarantino is he often talks about movies that never happen. He's mentioned like 5 or 6 projects that never come to fruition.
Right.
Because he doesn't work that often.
Right. Yeah, he has to really be passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And he's not one of those guys that just like goes into things very lightly.
Yeah, he does a lot of planning, a lot of prep, and he sometimes has abandoned projects.
Well, and I think that he has to rely like, he and Uma really work closely on the film, and he really has to, like, be in it. A couple of other things I found out, like, just by happenstance, like, apparently Uma Thurman and Daryl Hannah didn't get along in the film.
Really?
Yeah, they didn't like each other. The band, the 5678s, like, Quentin Tarantino just, like, he just heard him. He was over in Japan. Like, he was at a retail store or something like that, and he heard him over the speakers, and he went to the shop owner's like, "Who is this? I gotta have this CD." and he didn't have time to go to a music store to find it, so he convinced the guy to sell him like the CD right there in the store. And yeah, then got him back like a couple of years later to do, you know, Kill Bill.
Yeah, and they ended up being commercials, and they went on tour quite a bit. They've been here to Nashville.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's super cool. If they came, I might go see them.
Yeah,
that'd be really, really cool.
I actually like Japanese surf rock. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. And then there's also, I didn't want to mention it, but I'll just go ahead and mention it real quick. There's also like, when Uma Thurman was driving to Bill's house during the in those like mountainy roads, there was like an accident.
Yeah, she got hurt, and that was a bit of a controversy in early 2019, and she was misquoted where it was implied that it was Tarantino's fault, but then Uma Thurman later came out and said no, she was misquoted. She doesn't blame Tarantino. She doesn't think it was his fault.
And well, it's because she asked for a stunt driver.
Yeah,
which they can. I mean, the way that you can make it looked like you're driving is that they just put a car on a trailer and then you just like drive it around.
Yeah.
And that's what she wanted to do. And, you know, so they, you know, she was misquoted into saying that like, you know, Quentin Tarantino made her do it or something.
And really what happened was they talked about it and then she agreed to do it.
Right.
Yeah. So she wasn't forced to do it.
Yeah.
She changed her mind.
Yeah, she changed her mind.
She said as much later on. And her and Tarantino are still friends, you know. There's no ill will, but obviously they're talking about making more movies together, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because from what I understand, like, Quentin is very, like, accommodating to his actors. That if they feel uncomfortable about something, he will back off or whatever from it or whatever. Yeah. And it was one of those things where it was like, okay, we'll do this or we'll make accommodations or we'll reschedule or do whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how it all went down. I'm not saying, but... I'm saying she wasn't pressured by. She said she wasn't pressured by it.
Yeah, I remember reading the original interview and being like, "Oh, that sounds kind of bad on Quentin." And then like a month later, she's like, "No, no, I was misquoted. Here's what actually happened." You know?
Yeah, she kind of. She wound up getting an accident, hurting her knee, and like it really kind of hampered her. You know, taking jobs and like some of the action stuff that she could do after that, and she really like. She really kind of blamed Miramax, but like she wanted the footage released. That was what the big controversy was. Mm-hmm. Is she wanted the footage released because they were filming like the whole time, but Miramax didn't release it up until like Weinstein kind of got in some hot water.
She apparently hated Weinstein for good reason.
Yeah,
and that's what kind of led to all that coming out.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So wrapping up.
So if you had to rent this from the video store. Would you keep it or return it early?
I mean, I keep it.
I love these movies. I own them. I watch them more than once. I'll watch them again in the future.
Mm-hmm.
To me, they're very much an example of what I love about movies.
Really?
Yeah.
Expand on that a little bit. Then. Well, what you love? Like,
well,
we talked about it in the whole show, but. Yeah.
I love there's some it's like it was like a little sampler of everything I think is cool in movies. You have great dialogue, raw emotion, beautiful fight choreography, great music, iconic cinematography, you know, humor, pathos. Like if you could take everything I love about just movies in general and put it into a blender and create something new out of it, it would probably look a lot like this.
Mm.
So it's really almost a hodgepodge of all these little things that I love, like samurai films, kung fu movies, romance films, you know, all these things tied together, spaghetti westerns that I love deeply. And it's like this beautiful homage to all that.
I think it's really hard. Like, you know, I come from the music, like sort of, you know, musician, like, right. Yeah. And when you're a musician, like when you're starting band, like you do cover songs, right? Like you make what's popular and like you do it yourself. Cause it's like, they already, like people already know these songs or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like they know these Allman Brothers songs or they know these Tom Petty songs or like whatever, and get people dancing or excited. But to be able to turn it around and make stuff like that. And like, he's making like hodgepodge of like different genres. And it's almost like you're taking like, you know, Allman Brothers and mixing it with Pink Floyd, and then mixing it with like Dick Dale, and like how would that even sound like
a DJ?
Right, exactly. And it's almost like, And then he has all these, like, you know, vignettes. Like, you know, it's just like these little places and the development that it goes. It really seems like it's a real world that, like, really exists. Like, these things are real. And I think that's what a true mastery of, like, an artist. Like, if somebody watched, you know, this movie, they could think, like, wow, this, like, really happens. Like, Pulp Fiction is the same way. Like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood almost seems like that stuff really did happen, you know? So I think that attention to detail, that, like, visual storytelling, that, you know, it's absolutely amazing. Not because there's, like, oh, there's a black and white scene here or that, you know, or whatever. Or there's a long trailing, you know, shot from up above. Like, you know, somebody could put that in a movie, but if it doesn't really make sense, you know, then
it's got a beautiful rhythm to it.
Yeah. I mean, everything that's in there is, you could tell, is very deliberate.
Yes.
In the way that it's, like tugging at your, like, emotions and, like, you're watching what's going on and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's designed to elicit certain responses. It's very meticulous.
Right. And you never know what's going to happen next. You never know. It's so unpredictable.
And a movie that feels like it's going to be very predictable, you're right, it's never predictable, and that's one reason why it's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love these movies. And so let's move on to quick recommendations. I mentioned one. There's a movie called Lady Snowblood.
Okay.
It's a samurai film about a female swordsman.
Okay.
And over in Ishii, her look at the end of Kill Bill Volume 1, where she's in like the white kimono in the snow, is a direct homage to that movie. Like, that shot is almost directly out of this old samurai film from the 60s called Lady Snowblood. It's beautiful. It's artful. It's got some cool sword fights. A lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, Quentin Tarantino definitely got a lot of influence from, like, the grindhouse cinema.
Yeah.
And we never even touched on that at all.
Yeah. Well, we only have, this podcast is already running long.
Already running long. We can't go. Yeah. But, yeah, look it up. You kind of know what I mean. Yeah. I really don't have a whole lot of recommendations. Well, I will tell you, I'm not a big, like, kung fu guy. Don't watch.
Well, we're going to change that eventually. We're going to get there.
I would say, I mean, just to Quentin Tarantino's sake, one of my favorite movies that I like that's not a Tarantino directed film, but written by Tarantino, is a movie, True Romance. And it's one of my, it's a great movie. It stars Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette, where Patricia Arquette plays like a, she's like a entrapped, like, prostitute, and meets Christian Slater, and Christian Slater's like, no, this is not right. I'm breaking you out. Like, I'm getting you out of this deal.
It's a Tarantino romance.
And yeah, it's, that's, yeah. So he basically sold the script to make, so he could fund his own, movie to make,
Pulp Fiction. Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs. I was thinking Pulp Fiction.
It was ran with me.
Right. It's late in the day. I got to get home.
Yeah.
But yeah, he made Reservoir Dogs, and because he really wanted to make, like, you know, True Romance, but
it's a bigger movie. He didn't.
Right.
He didn't have the money. He didn't have the talent to do it. Yeah. I mean, by talent, I mean he didn't have the actors to do it.
And some of the ending and stuff like that is, like, really rewritten, but you can tell it has Tarantino, like, written all
over. It's got his DNA all over. Like, the dialogue feels like him. The structure feels like him. It feels like one of his movies. And there's a connection to Kill Bill in True Romance, so it's funny you mentioned that one. In True Romance, Christian Slater takes her to the movies. They go see a kung fu movie starring a man named Sonny Chiba. And they show a clip of the Sonny Chiba film called The Street Fighter. Sonny Chiba plays Hattori Hanzo.
Also, the glasses worn by Buck
were by Clarence's Elvis glasses. Yeah,
they were the same glasses, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. They might have been the same type.
The same type.
Yeah. Which, like, the Elvis glasses, basically. Yeah.
So there's always connections. There's always threads tying his stuff together. Mm-hmm. So, good call.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps it up for this week's edition of Video Culture. Oh, it's been a long week, and I hope that you really enjoy it, and I hope that you really get your kung fu and your western on and enjoy some Quentin Tarantino. Yeah.
Enjoy a bloody tale of retribution and revenge. And if you don't like it, well, at least we didn't lie to you about it. We tried to sell it to you.
And if you've seen it, we hope that you enjoyed us talking about it.
Thanks again, guys. We'll see you next week. Or not next week, but in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks!
And go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, come hang out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Friends and I, we were the creme de la creme in an exclusive industry. And we all worked for this man, Bill. Then one day, I decided to leave, settle down, and start a new life. But when I tried to get out, they did me in.
Don't you ever wake up.
I guess they should have tried a little harder.
So I suppose it's a little late for an apology, huh?
You suppose correctly.
Now it's kill or be killed.
You have every right to want to get even.
Get even? Even, Stephen? I would have to kill you. That'd be about square.
And I choose kill.
Mommy, I'm home.
Hey, baby. How was school?
One ticket to Tokyo, please. One way.
That woman deserves her revenge. And we deserve to die.
No kidding, I heard it was kind of hard.
Silly Caucasian girl likes to play with samurai swords.
Yeah. Oh. Any more subordinates for me to kill?
Hi.
Go home to your mother.
You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you? For a second there?
Yeah. I kind of did.
Silly rabbit.
Hard part's over.